Accession number 10403, reel 12.
Harold Sal, Reel 12. How long did you stay at the two camps in the desert?
Not very long. It might have been a few weeks. But the brigade commander, Dixie Redman, had gone to Cairo to meet the GOC. And within 24 hours, I was asked to go and meet him in the Shepherd's Hotel, Cairo, where they were both having dinner. I immediately went to bed. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was woken and put in a truck and went down to Heliopolis Airport.
Did you know what was going on?
Not until I was airborne. When I got there, I found there was a reception party already waiting with some officers from the division, the divisional headquarters, and they got on the plane, and it was a Bombay, I remember, and they hadn't very much accommodation, so I went in as the rear gunner in order to get his seat. Not that I could have done much good. And so I spent the journey for where going up in Cyprus looking backwards in the rear end of a Bombay as the rear gunner. And we went over the Sinai, which there was a lot of turbulence. We seemed to bounce up and down an awful lot. Then we went to Beit Lid. And I'm not certain, but I think there, which we stopped for a time, it was to fuel up and to change the markings. I think they stuck some Turkish markings over the British roundels because we flew up north. And as we were going up north, we were being briefed that we were going to Cyprus. And we came round through the north of Cyprus from over the top, which I assume will now be Turkey, and came into Cyprus and dropped onto the airport at Nicosia.
How was it explained? What were you told you were there for?
Well, we were told in the air that Crete having fallen, that the division was being brought as quickly as possible by sea and by air into Cyprus to prepare to defend it against the coming invasion from Crete, and that we had to get in as quickly as possible. We'd be briefed further when we got to Nicosia. And so when we arrived at Nicosia, there was vehicles waiting for us. We went straight to the governor's palace in Nicosia, where there was quite a number of people assembled. There were maps of the whole island. The island was divided into three areas, and my brigade, that was the 151 Brigade, was allocated the whole of the area from the line drawn across the island, including Nicosia and Kyrenia and the Troodos Mountains. So we then hastily drew up on the plan where we would allocate each battalion provisionally. I hastily then, within 2 days, the first flights were beginning to come in. So I went to Famagusta, got the troops off the ships, put them on the train as it was then, and then we got them up and dropped them off at Nicosia. We had lorries, and we lorried them to the various parts where each unit and subunit was going. Brigade headquarters was placed at a place called Lacatabia, Cato Lacatabia, and we were in an orange grove there. And for the next several months, we spent our time doing recces all the way around the island, fixing where our defensive positions would be, also arranging that if the invasion did come and we were forced to take to the hills, where to put our supplies. And we even went so far as to dig what we call the keep, which was a defensive area near Cato Lacatabia, in which we were putting in 3 months' supplies of all sorts, including underground bunkers and for hospitals, etc. all this was going on. And it's interesting to note, in hindsight, that when we did the appreciation of how the Germans would invade the North, and we got our plans out on how to defeat them, that when the Turks invaded Cyprus, they carried out exactly the same plans as the Germans and dropped their parachutists to the exact area where we had prepared our anti-parachute defenses. So it looks as though that the appreciations weren't so far wrong. So I then spent the next several months, we were organizing the battalion, spending my time with the battalions, going around and getting the scene that the supplies were in, that they had everything for the defense, the ammunition supplies, the training. And it was a very busy time. We spent this, we lived in the open. We just had mosquito nets, which we hung from carob trees and slept underneath them. I slept in a little garden, which was occupied by a Turk and his wife, who were very happily irrigating the place with a donkey and a well. We got on very well with them.
How about the Cyprus population generally? How did the troops and yourself get on with them?
Very well indeed. The both the Cypriot and the Turkish communities invited the troops into their functions. I mean, whether it was at their weddings, troops were always asked to go, and troops made themselves agreeable and they were pleasant, and they reciprocated. We didn't have any trouble either with the Greeks or with the Turks. We made our peace with the Greek Orthodox Church, and we made our peace with the imams and the Kiko monasteries which were about the place. And
what do you mean? You made your peace. What do you mean?
Well, we made ourselves agreeable. We went along, and when I used to go along and see the boss man and take an interpreter and explain why we were there, and asked him if there was anything that he would like us not to do. Were there any special peculiarities that the inhabitants might take offense? And when we had these talks, and he went back and told his people what I had said, and vice versa, everybody met each other halfway and made allowances for each other's ignorance. And got on quite well.
Now, what did you think of Redmond? He'd been your brigade commander for quite a while now.
Yes.
Give us an assessment of his abilities and his character.
Well, it's not for me to give an assessment of his abilities. Suffice to say that somebody else must have thought very highly of him, because eventually he became deputy CIJGS after the war. But in his personal life and in his way, he was a man of strong character and exemplary conduct. He was religious in a quiet way. For wherever we went in the Middle East, we turned up, he had an annotated Bible, and we turned up the references in them, and he always made a point of looking and debating various things about the Holy Land and what took place. And his principles were very, very high indeed, and we had many, many discussions.
Did you get on with him as well as you had with Churchill?
Yes, I got on with him very, very well indeed. I don't know why. I did not pull any punches. I merely restated the situation as I saw the non-professional soldier vis-a-vis the regular soldier, and said that we were out to do everything under his guidance, and we asked for his help to achieve the final end. And this was the attitude which we adopted, and we got on very well together.
So what happened next after this period at Cyprus?
Well, in this period of Cyprus, it was taken up by all sorts of things. Our problem then, of course, was malaria. And the local booze, three-star bandy, was about 1 shilling a bottle. And to chaps who are used to drinking pints of Durham ale, A pint of brandy used to have a pretty horrific effect. But our discipline was good, and we issued out the usual punishments for fellows who got too much of this stuff. But we hadn't any other problems. And we remained on that island, preparing and doing all our recce's, doing training, very heavy training, marching, firing our weapons, coordination with the artillery, Air Force cooperation. We had some air cover there. And then we, one night in the middle of when we were preparing for winter, we had got to the stage of having to make our own houses. We were going to make our own houses to live in out of mud bricks, like the pharaohs did. And we were ready to build our houses and got all this done with the help of the RAs. And one night, my brigade commander asked me to accompany him to divisional headquarters. And I went to the divisional headquarters, and the divisional commander, who was Ramsden, said he'd called for the brigade commander to be accompanied by one staff officer. And for some reason or other, Dixie asked me to go. And I went with him, and the divisional commander and all his staff were there, and they said, the Russian invasion of Germany had been preceded by the German invasion of Russia by 6 weeks, and that they had caught the Russian armies in their most vulnerable position. That was to say, they were on their start lines or on their forming up areas, but not on their start lines, and a German attack had overrun them, and it was proceeding so fast that they reckoned that within 2 months, or within 6 weeks, 4 armored divisions would have reached the Don. Thereafter, they would push into the Caucasus, through the 2 passes in the Caucasus, down into the oil fields behind us, and that the division had to get into the passes as fast as ever they could to stop them. This was the sort of gist of the conference. And to that end, the entire division had to leave Cyprus within 3 days. Ships were coming in. We had to leave all our equipment on the ground, carry only our personal weapons and the minimum of personal clothing, leave everything on the ground, and our place would be taken over by the 5th Indian Div. The 5th Indian Div were then in Haifa. And the idea was the ships would bring them in. They would come in. As the ship went back, they would take us out. We would take over all their equipment, which they'd left on the ground. And they would take over ours. However, I went out on the destroyer Kingston. No, I went out on the minesweeper, the Abbeville. And I went out on the Abbeville at the rate of about 40 knots and arrived at Haifa the next morning. And I went out first to see the lie of the land and was absolutely horrified at what we had to take over in the way of equipment. Because the bright boys in Cairo, whilst on paper, it's easy to switch one division for another. When one's Indian and one's European, there's a hell of a difference. And we found that all the stores we took over were to fit Indians. Your boots wouldn't fit. Your clothing, your food, everything else wouldn't fit. Presumably they would find the same. However, we had to be refitted in Haifa and round Beit Lid, and all new ammunition, which took some little time. And I remember people had taken this order literally. And I was interviewed by the padre from the 9th DLI, who came and said that he had left his surplus, his chalice, and all his hymn books and everything else, folding tabernacles, on the floor in Cyprus. And that all he could find over here, over in the Indian Div, was a board studded with nails. And what was I going to do about it? So those were the sort of things that happened. It was the adjustment between the two. And so we refitted out as an individual, as a division. When then we were told that we would be moving along the desert road, eventually to Baghdad, and then finally make our way up to the oil fields, Kirkut, Mosul, beyond. And we would do the best we could, going along the best way we could. Well, the whole of the unit, the whole of the brigade was formed up in column of route, and they moved along the Vale of Esdraelon and over the Jordan, onto the pipelines, onto Transjordan. And the idea was that I would move roughly 2 days ahead. I would go with a jeep and a three-tonner full of petrol and a couple of other acts, and I'd go to the next watering place or the next staging camp, see that everything was all right, await for the troops coming in, see that there was the information was passed to them, what the where the water was, etc., etc., and then immediately leave for the next one. And this went on, and I remember going into Rutbar, which I thought was an evil sort of place, and then there were no roads, it was just across the sand. And it's the first time I'd ever done a desert crossing. It was the first time I'd been on those sort of missions in the country like that, and I was merely told, there it is, those are instructions. You get to Baghdad first of all and get a hold of the OC troops there and await us and tell us what the form is. And off I went. I suppose I might have done it with some bit of trepidation in later life, but at that time I thought it was, as a young fellow, I thought it was a marvellous assignment. And I remember getting to Habaniya, and at that time we had the Rashid Ali rebellion going on, which had just been, they'd just been shot up and chased out. And Habaniya, the siege of Habaniya, which was the Air Force base, was over. And I went to Habaniya and found out the area just nearby where they would be camping, and near the Habaniya Lake where the seaplanes can get in. And I remember spending the first night. There was still a lot of Rashid Ali boys about, and I got a tip from one of the garrison at Habaniya that I should not sleep in my bivouac tent. I should erect my bivouac tent, apparently go to bed, and then quietly, when it was dark, crawl out underneath, go about 30 yards away, dig a hole and lie in it for the night. I did this, and the first night there was a rattle of gunfire and my bivouac was full of holes. So ever afterwards I never slept in a bivouac. This was the type of country. You never saw anybody. These Arab fellows were somewhere in the hills like the sands. I remember waking up the next morning to a peculiar sort of a smell, and found that just outside my tent was an Arab leg sticking out of the ground. It was apparently on the site of the old battlefield, and everybody had been buried on the spot, and the wild dogs and the various other animals had come along, and I was camped myself in the middle of it. So I immediately switched to another area for when the troops came in the day or the day after. From then on, we...
Were you shot at any other time while you were... Because you were fairly isolated, just on your own.
Oh, yes. Well, you would. You would get these shots from... You didn't know where they came from. There were sand dunes and everything. You were not shot at the day. You used to be shot at, usually at sunrise or sunset. And there were not... It was not heavy shooting. You would have two or three rounds fired at you, and then if you fired back or you fired, so you never heard any more. It was a hit and run business. There was nothing to see.
When they shot at you, would there be reason? How accurate were they, or couldn't you tell?
Well, it would fall in the sand not 2 or 3 yards away from you. I mean, you would see the sand spurt up. But you don't know how far they were away. Couldn't see them.
How about the Iraqis you did see? What was their attitude? The civilians?
Well, the civilians were like all the Middle Eastern people. They used to live in these mud hovels. And they were always shy. If there were if you caught up with the nomads, they were very hospitable. But when you were in the towns, it was a different kettle of fish. You kept out of the towns. You kept away from them. You must remember that they just had a rebellion. Rashid Ali, who was pro-Germans, had attacked and taken over the administration and had attacked the installations of the Allies. And the Allies had just been up there, knocked hell out of them, and chased them all the way back up the country back, so that nobody had much idea what was going on. In fact, I suppose the average native, whether we looked like Germans or English or Chinese, he wouldn't know. He just distrusted the lot of us, with reason, no doubt.
Was there any more incidents in the journey after
Habakkuk? No, it was a long slog up, and we got to, I crossed the Almri Bridge, and I went and saw the headquarters in Baghdad, told them who I was. They were expecting it, of course. I got the instructions that we were being. A staging camp was just north of Baghdad, called Terz Kabatli, I think they called. I'm not certain what it was, anyhow. And when I got there to see what the conditions would be for the troops, I found one or two officers only and about 5 tents. And I saw these chaps and I said, well, where are the troops? They said, oh, well, there they are. They're asleep. And they explained that they were all Gurkhas. And their job was to look after us at night, because there was a place called Hit just across the river, across the Tigris, near the Tigris. And these characters would come out from there at night and start pillaging and shooting and all this business. And the Gurkhas used to deal with them. They used to deal with them very effectively. The Gurkhas slept by day and chopped their heads off by night. Very efficient. So then we moved up to the Injana police post and into Kirkut, where the division was, and then that was the headquarters of a Sikh Indian brigade. There was, I think the Rajputs were up there as well, or the Jats. No, it was a Jat battalion, and the Sikhs, and everybody was thinking in terms of this anti-invasion role of the Germans coming through. So we pushed up, and we got up near Mosul to took up a defensive position. The first defensive position we were going to take as a stop line was the line of the two rivers called the Great Zab and the Little Zab. The brigade dug in there. All bridges were blown. We had to put our own bridges up, been blown by the retreating Rashid Ali gang. Almost. Started the normal drill of defensive positions, digging defences, training, getting the ammunition up, training the troops, marches, toughening up, repeating the same drill. And
what was the weather like?
Well, when we went there, it was getting very cold. It was getting November, that sort of time. And it wasn't very long before the snows came and the frost came. And it got so cold, because when I went on other recces further north, it was colder still. But in that area where we were first doing it, we had a great deal of trouble with the cold. It was so cold that you took your water bottle and put it inside your shirt, or else it would be a block of ice next morning. Your water carts were all frozen. We used to start our vehicles, although they were antifreeze, up 5 minutes to the hour, every hour, and run them for 5 minutes, or else you'd have lost all your vehicles by frost.
Did you have enough of the right sort of stores to keep you warm? Because weren't you in KD?
We were in KD, and we hadn't any battle dress or anything, and that came up. But then that was a problem again, because it had to come from Indian supplies. You see, that part of the world was supplied from India, and a lot of the stuff came up from Basra. And of course, there was the problem of the different shape of people. We had 8th DLI had one sergeant, Tall Harrison, who was a very big man. There was no chance of giving him trousers, so he had to make a kilt out of a blanket. And but anyway, we did quite well up there. We very ingenious. We used to go to bed at night. We made improvised beds out of wire netting and dug 3 holes underneath and put hurricane lamps in each hole underneath the bed, then put all our clothes on, and then put the 2 blankets on the top of us, each draped down each side, and let the heat from the lamps come up like a central heating. Troops were catered for. Ross McLaren made a great invention. He was a mining engineer. And he went down to the oil fields and he got 40-gallon drums of oil and 40-gallon drums of water. And we had marquee-like tents, which the troops were lined side by side all the way down like sardines. And down the center, he dug a hole, a trench, which he covered with flat stones we got from the river. And then he set the 2 bottles up outside the tent, turned on the water slowly and the oil slowly, and then lit it. And the lighted oil flowed on top of the water, down the trench, through the tent, underneath the stones, and turned it into a Roman hypocaust. And of course, the tent was then walled beautifully. You can, in fact, always boil your tea on the stones as they went through the centre of the tent. Many ingenious devices.
You couldn't do that for long, could you? How long would that last for, that arrangement?
Well, it lasted for several weeks or so more until we were frozen in. Fortunately, I don't know whether it's fortunately or not, but the weather came on prematurely. The Russian winter came on prematurely, and the Germans were frozen in the Kuban on the Don, and we were frozen in up there. And so it didn't come to anything. And we stayed there, and then whilst we were up there, we got a new brigade commander called Crusher Nichols. Dixie was then sent for, and he went back to the desert to become BIGS, General Staff. And Crusher Nichols came and took over from us.
What kind of a man was he?
Extraordinary chap, Crusher. Had been a very successful, dashing type of commander in the Western Desert. He was very fit. It used to fill you with horror to wake up in the morning and see the figure of Crusher dressed in shorts, standing on a block of ice, doing exercises with his knees and his nose as blue as a bottle of ink. But he was a fit fanatic. He was at one time in charge of the physical training center of the regular army. He was a regular soldier, of course, World War I. He was a fit man and a very brave type of chap, reckless type of chap. Always believed in aggression, you know. He always used to believe in aggression. I recollect him. First meeting we had, he said, my name's Nichols. I'm very fit. I expect every one of you to be very fit. I don't allow people to slack. I'm out to seek battle. And whilst I am seeking the battle, I have one requirement from any of you. And that is, you either get a military cross or a wooden one, and nothing in between. And that was his temperament. He walked through a minefield, not even bothering to whether he stepped on a mine or not. He walked straight through.